You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode, this hour, is Michaela Brangan.
Hello. So,
hi. It's good to have you here this morning.
Great to be here.
So the way the show starts is with a huge question, and you can take it any way you want. Who are you? What do we need to know about how you aspire to live, what you do, the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start this conversation? we do kind of walk through life with labels, whether we want to or not.
Well, I did just participate in my department's commencement. I just earned my PhD in English at Cornell.
Cool.
And so I'm actually soon going to be a professor at Amherst College in Northampton, or I'll be living in Northampton, but I'll be in the Pioneer Valley.
Right.
In a few months.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, so congratulations.
Thank you. My time in Ithaca is about to close.
Wow.
Yeah. After 7 years.
Yes. Well, and you actually finished only kind of 1 year out of cycle.
I think that in my discipline, it's the average is 6.2 years or something. Uh-huh. So I think most people get it in 7 or 8. And then there's a few people who
do
make the
four.
Rest of us look bad.
Yeah. I was on the 11-year plan. I wrote 3 different versions of the dissertation before I got one that was acceptable to my committee and to me. It was, we don't want to go down that path.
Yeah. I continue to work at that. Just, you know how it goes. You get the job and then you have to write the dissertation. It's kind of backwards in a way.
Right. But that is a good kind of backwards.
Yeah.
You've got something really to get out the door for.
Yeah. I'm excited. I'm really excited. The department that I'm going to teach in is exactly... I work on law and literature, so I also have a JD in... that's a law degree, and I work on basically the intersection between law, politics, and culture. So my department is going to be... It's called Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought.
Uh-huh.
So and it's not a traditional English job. It's more like an interdisciplinary...
It's a job that had your name on it.
Basically, yeah. It's kind of like if one could describe it in science fiction terms, it's like the mothership of my discipline, and then I'm a shuttle coming back to join the.
Yes.
My work is also on science. I work on experimental and speculative fiction.
So. Yeah. And you also described us as a music geek.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I worked at record stores for a collective. Decade, I guess, like in high school and college, after college.
Long after there were LPs.
No, there still are LPs.
That is true.
No, it's. I mean, I no longer
actually. Yes.
Exactly. I no longer participate in that. That economy, I guess. But I do have a show on this radio station on Sunday nights at 9 o'clock. And I spin records with my friend Jeff, who is also a PhD candidate in science and technology studies at Cornell. And it's called Territory Shall Mean the Universe. So
okay,
both of us kind of live out our record geekdom on the air.
And it's just music from your collections?
Is there another
more narrow theme than that? Or
it's actually pretty broad. I mean, I named it after a contract term. There's this in contracts. There's these definitions. It's like what to decide what the terms are in a contract. And one of the ones that always struck me as rather amazing is territory, like the definition for territory, and it's shall mean whatever jurisdiction. So one I read was territory shall mean the universe. So basically that contract applies no matter what, no matter where you are.
It is always enforced.
Yes. Yeah. Cool. Which is funny to me because it's also just a weird concept altogether.
Right. And it doesn't even assume a temporal element.
No, I mean, it's like as though the words on that piece of paper mean anything whenever you're getting out to the outer reaches of existence. So.
You brought music with you. What should we start with today?
I thought we would start with Odetta, Take This Hammer, which is actually a cover by, I think originally it was a Leadbelly song.
Yeah, that's what I was seeing in the
writings.
Yeah.
And if I can say a little bit about Odetta, she was sort of considered to be this quote-unquote voice of the civil rights movement. and her voice, when I heard it at the first, I'm not unique in this. I think a lot of folk singers thought this, Bob Dylan thought this, a lot of, like I think Joan Baez as well, but her voice has got this incredible timbre. And the reason I chose her is because I also was deeply involved, or as much as one can say deeply involved, with the labor movement here at Cornell whenever we were organizing. Mm-hmm. I was actually just on Teresa Ault's show last week, the Inquiring Socialist, talking about sort of where we are. So I wanted to kick off with that just because it's also kind of it's a vigorous song and like get us going on Sunday.
Okay, Odetta and Take This Hammer. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Michaela Brangan. I'm sorry.
It's an odd one.
Well, I will get it right sooner or later. And part of my show is also modeling the question that doesn't work, or the mispronounced name, or the whole everything that we do in our daily life that has to get to know each other. So, given the life that you value living now that you have two graduate degrees and an undergraduate degree, and you've got a professional career, and you've done work in a number of places, I'm assuming, from what I've heard what have you had to learn? What experiences have you had to have? Did you have to have to value the life you value now, so you have a sense of how to live it?
Oh, so interesting. You should ask. You know, I actually grew up with a family that did not value an education. I grew up in a Jehovah's Witness family, and I don't know if you know much about that particular religion.
That's my background. Yeah, yeah. One of the renewal movements of the 19th century. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. We should definitely talk.
I would come out of the Campbellite movement, which is another renewal movement.
Oh my God, earlier so than interesting. I actually grew up thinking that I was never going to go to college because I believed, well, I'm not sure if I believed it so much, but it was sort of imposed upon me mm-hmm. that I was, you know, that was not my destiny, that the thing that I should be looking forward to was a life of dedication and ministry. Mm-hmm. And it never really floated my boat, to be honest. I was always a bit like, this doesn't seem feasible to me. And I loved learning, mm-hmm. period. I got out books from the library. And interestingly, you know, my parents, unlike some of the other parents who were Jehovah's Witness parents, did, especially my mother, did encourage me to read widely. I mean, mm-hmm. there were some books I wasn't supposed to read, but I hid them
with
in my
stacks.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And I wouldn't say I was an autodidact so much as I was just someone who was thirsty for knowledge. And I tried for a while to sort of compromise myself and like make it work in a way that they thought was going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I actually pursued a photography degree or fine arts degree before I ended up going into like a more academic track. I ended up transferring schools and going to the University of Washington for my undergraduate, and I didn't, you know, really pursue that. But the reason I did that was because I thought, oh, this is something I could justify to them as like vocational. Mm-hmm. Like I actually looked at like photography as vocational, which is obviously not what attracted me to it. Like I liked making art or like, you know, and thinking about art.
But you had to justify, at least in the regard you had for your parents and their and your experience of expectations, you had to meet that in some way.
Yeah. I realized later that it wasn't going to really work. They were proud of me for my accomplishments in ways that I couldn't actually myself understand. Mm-hmm. I think that we were on two different planes, but they were able eventually to kind of reconcile themselves to the fact that I was not going to pursue the path that they wanted for me, mm-hmm. but they were able to think about it in terms of like, okay, she's okay. She's doing something that we can't really get in a way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I, you know, of course was like, I just couldn't go back, you know, mm-hmm, like
right.
It's not like I could event like just be like, I've forgotten everything I've known. And like, I'm going to go back to this particular narrow, what I consider to be a narrow path.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, my parents and I have a bit of a strange relationship, just largely because Jehovah's Witnesses are extremely strict in their associations.
Strict and insular.
Very insular, yeah. And very, very doctrinal, mm-hmm. you know? So, like, there's just certain things that they don't do. so, that's kind of the thing I think I had to learn, if one could say I learned something, was to figure out a way to navigate that mm-hmm. and be okay with it. Because you're not, my dad actually is from the Ozarks, and he has got a ton of little sayings that he says all the time.
Ozarks is notorious for sayings. I come from North Missouri. So
oh.
I have relatives who live in South Missouri. So.
Yeah. But, you know, you can please some of the people some of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing. And
that's actually Mark Twain. But no, actually, I don't know who that is.
Oh, well,
no,
I'm sure he didn't make that.
Yeah,
but, yeah, I mean, I would say I learned that. Like, I learned to figure it in a way that was going to be okay for me. And it was really hard because it ended up putting me on a really like non-traditional mm-hmm. student path. Like I'm older than the average PhD student by, you know, 3-4 years.
Right, right. But one of the things about these religious traditions that can be somewhat insular, if they are true to form, they expect the person to make decisions. And to make the decisions that they're willing to live by,
mm-hmm.
and coercion is off the table when they are true to their better form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coercion is all over the place if people are being reactive and regressive. But it sounds like you were in an environment that, where your parents could respect your decision even if they didn't understand it or agree with it.
Yeah, and that was not the case with many of the friends that I grew up with in that religion. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some people who were simply taken out of school.
Right.
You know, they were homeschooled, and that's not necessarily a choice that I condemn. For there's lots of reasons why people homeschool, but this, the reason for the witnesses was largely because they didn't want their kids to be exposed to too many ideas, basically.
Right.
And I'm really, really happy that my parents, well, that they didn't do that. And the reasons why they didn't do that were probably circumstantial. You know, we were poor, working family, you know,
mm-hmm.
we couldn't really afford for my parents both not to work. So, but at the same time, I think my mom did vicariously live through me.
You. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And your father
likes to see my accomplishments.
Right. Right. And your father's from the Show Me State. Which means prove it to me.
Definitely. Yeah.
And there's, you want to say, I mean, and that's,
he's that very proud of the fact that I, as he says, learn to row my own canoe.
Yes, in a perfect mix.
And I'm from Alaska, so of course that has like all kinds of other connotations with uh-huh. rowing your own canoe.
Yes, yes.
Building your own.
Yeah, yeah. And you're from Alaska.
I'm from Alaska.
Yeah. Cool. What should we go to next musically?
Let's go, actually, since we're on the topic of my father, we go to the Joni Mitchell song All I Want off the record Blue. I first heard this song when we were driving in the car and going fishing in the Kenai Peninsula, and I always wanted to play this record just over and over again. Right. It's one of my favorite records.
We have something in common. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Michaela Brangan. So, Michaela, you've talked about how some of the things you've had to learn to kind of get out and get an education, but what has surprised you? What did you, when you got out, what surprised you that you did not expect to find?
Oh, well, I grew up in Alaska, which... It was the biggest town in Alaska, Anchorage. Not even a town. It's a, you know, sort of a big city. Very, very spread out. Lots of, you know, it's like half the population. But it is really, really separate from the rest mm-hmm. of the contiguous United States. And there's a special culture in Alaska. And actually, since we're, 10 years out from everybody meeting Sarah Palin for the first time, I was surprised actually at how similar things were in the contiguous United States as Alaska. But then I was also like, realized how I was really excited to move from Alaska to, I went to college in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I was actually surprised. I would walk around and it seemed like, this is going to sound really cliche, and I'm usually more critical than this, but it's Sunday. Just the, universality of human struggle. Like, mm-hmm. I think that, like, I became politicized or I should say, kind of aware of that stuff. Like when I did make that move, because Alaska is in a lot of ways very insular. And I was also in as you pointed out, a really insular community, the Jehovah's Witnesses. But I always had managed to kind of make myself learn more things. Mm-hmm. And then I thought everything was going to be so different when I moved. And I was surprised at how similar everybody was. And then I went to law school in New York City, which of course everybody is like, oh, New York is like, it's globally known as being just this place. And as I'm not trying to flatten things, like obviously like cultures differ. There's mm-hmm. all of these different like ways of being in different places. But I've found myself, I'm surprised that I'm unsurprised, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. about like the ways that everybody kind of has, really brought up the same, concerns. And it actually makes me feel more connected, mm-hmm. I guess,
Well, New York City was the headquarters in the Bronx for a while, and then in Brooklyn for the Jehovah's Witnesses. Mm-hmm. So there's no antipathy.
And now they're moving out. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they've sold all their property in New York City, and they are in Warwick, New York now.
Okay. But there was this comfort, or at least willingness to be in the urban environment.
Yeah, I always thought like, oh, if I go to this big city, like, everything's going to be different. And then, yes, there were definitely things that were different, like different opportunities, mm-hmm. different, different kinds of points of access. But
what was the sameness?
I think that the sameness is, God, this is so corny. The sameness is like everybody wants to figure out the best way for them to connect with other people. And everybody's like scrambling to figure out that mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like a given, we're living in the age of digital communication, and there's almost like so much ability or access mm-hmm. to connect with other people. And I'm a socialist, and I really believe strongly that when it comes down to it, everybody is struggling for the same things. And I think that the mm-hmm. sameness to me is that desire to right. connect with other people.
Yeah. And I think
we mess it up all the time.
right. And I think people sometimes the underlying desire is connection, but oftentimes the underlying desire is also tainted by a need for control,
mm-hmm.
and that means a need to have power over, or resources, or assets over, or more than others, and that gets dicey.
Yeah, and I think I
but
mean,
that's I'm, true where I come from in Missouri. I imagine that's true in Alaska too.
Well, Alaska is the last frontier, and my dad this would take like a whole other radio show to talk about how my parents met. But like one of the main reasons why my father moved to Alaska was because he was a disillusioned Vietnam vet and really, really just wanted to build a new life somewhere where there mm-hmm. was what was untainted by what he considered to be the worst kind of control, which was federal state control.
Sure.
You know, he was an employee of the state and, you know, in the worst way, in one of the worst wars that can be even talked about. So, you know, there's a lot of people up in Alaska who I think really, they're very friendly people, mm-hmm. honestly. Like, they're, you know, there's some weirdos that they say the odds are good, but the goods are odd in relation to the disproportion between men and women there. But there's, you know, I think that a lot of people go up there with this idea that it's like the one of the last places mm-hmm. you can go to kind of like forge your own path mm-hmm. and maybe make a world for yourself that's new mm-hmm. Or, you know, unexpected or untainted, one could say.
Yeah, yeah.
But putting it that way, yeah, like the notion that there's this whole, you know, desire, I would say control's one way of putting it, or agency. Mm-hmm. You know, like the ability to like actually see yourself in the world that you're mm-hmm. making.
Yeah. And but the difference between being agency and being control is that you can see the impact and you can accept that other people will have more impact than you, and that it's an engagement that matters more than an outcome.
Yeah.
You can discover what's possible. And I went and met with the Democratic Socialists when I was here as an undergrad, you know, 40 odd years ago, because there was nothing like the cooperativist roots that I came from in Missouri. We had the National Farmers Organization.
Oh,
president. It was in the town I grew up in, went to the same church I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And this cooperativist, which is basically anarchism by consent,
mm-hmm.
you know,
consensus
or by consent, you know, because anarchists only do what there is no head to tell you what to do. You have to choose. And if you're going to work together, you all have to choose to work together, which is like socialism by consent mm-hmm. as opposed to coercion. And that's where, you know, so we're coming from similar roots here, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Different, very different labels.
Yeah. I mean, my parents chose a religion that actually forbids you from voting. So,
yeah.
But it's definitely like the notion of free will is really important mm-hmm. in their religion. And it's also like once you enter, there's no turning back without serious consequences.
Right.
And I think like my work is around, or at least my dissertation, I you know, work on law and fiction stuff. But I work on the contract form. So like, like different ways that people make agreements with each other.
Right. And we will go down this path, but let's play music first and then we'll talk about covenants and contracts because there's that's my dissertation.
Oh my God. Anyway. I'm so happy we've met. So,
but we'll have fun with it. We'll play. Okay.
Okay.
What should we play next?
Let's play the Smiths, The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. And the reason I picked this song is because the first time I ever got like really serious about being a music geek was when I found a recording of this album, which is called The Queen is Dead, at a thrift store. It was actually like a you know, just a taped recording of this album. And I found it and I was like, oh, you know, check this band out. And that's kind of what put me down
this
downward spiral.
So this was somebody's personal tape, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I just found it at a thrift store.
Believe me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Michaela Brangan. So, Michaela, I gather from what you were saying before, your area of study is how we form and maintain and maybe even enforce commitments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my work is on the contract form and its relationship with realism in literary fiction. So, just the quick elevator speech is that in literary theory, there's this connection between the novel realism and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And Ian Watt, who wrote this book called The Rise of the Novel, it's a very, you know, sort of seminal study of realism,
mm-hmm.
talked very uncritically about the fact that the contract was like the way that we organize our lives now. And this is like back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
The rise of the contract form, you know, there are these sort of historical markers where it went from being simply promises that would be randomly enforced by ecclesiastical courts to this thing that was actually a form that you could make elements that aligned with, you know, a kind of formal agreement, and then the court, like the actual law court, mm-hmm. could enforce. And then there was also this sort of, you know, notion that contracts are everywhere, and like the ways that people think about the relationship with the state, social contract theory, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff, takes on this contract format.
So what is a contract?
A contract is a promise made to either do or not do something that is valid in the future and that is enforceable.
Mm-hmm.
So my dissertation is called Future Promises, Reconfiguring the Contract in Experimental and Speculative Fiction. So what I do is I look at the contract and how it works in non-realist or anti-realist forms of fiction to show how basically it works, to expose its elements, because... Mm-hmm. The contract is often just thought about as this mundane thing, you know, mm-hmm. but we make them all the time and they end up creating things in our lives that are not inevitable. So the contract
they're only inevitable if we believe we have to abide by them.
Exactly. So, right. So I look at it as a world making device,
sure.
basically.
Right.
And those worlds that we make, are, you know, sort of built around this form that has in many ways kind of come to stand in for other kinds of like sort of social formats. So like, mm-hmm. One thing that's been in the news a lot lately are arbitration mm-hmm. clauses.
Sure.
And there was actually just a Supreme Court decision that came down last week, and that one could actually be compelled to abide by a clause that your boss sends you an email that says if you continue working, you're agreeing to this new clause, which these arbitration clauses are essentially rights-denying clauses. Like, you can no longer go to court.
You give up your legal rights.
You give up your legal rights in court. To sue, basically.
Right.
Which is, I mean, the right to sue is something that's embodied in the Civil Rights Act. You know, like any
violation of what is tort or whatever. I mean, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But like it's what's considered to be, you know, part and parcel of what it is to be a citizen. So
mm-hmm.
like yep. if you're agreeing to this and like you can essentially be compelled to do this and are said to be, you know, under this particular form, like at what point does a contract itself become not a contract, but like a sort of almost self-enforcing or self-executing law? You know, mm-hmm. it's like those are the kinds of questions I attack mm-hmm. in my dissertation. Mm-hmm. So.
And what are examples of what are the stories in, I can't forget the two terms you used.
Experimental and speculative.
Yes, yes, yes.
So the reason I look through those is largely because, you know, there's this sort of uncritical notion that like the contract is the way that like realism is, like it is real. This is in mm-hmm. my discipline. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. There's one of the novels I work on is called Remainder. It's a novel from 2005, and the work I do is mostly contemporary, mm-hmm. even though mm-hmm. I do look at like sort of a historic, like I do work historically. And this novel is, it's from an English author who is very fascinated with like French literary theory, particularly like post-structuralist mm-hmm. literary theory, like Roland Barthes and stuff. And Barthes said that the relationship between the reader and the text is a contract. That the narrative is a form of contract. And this novel is about a person who experiences this like horrible loss of memory about mm-hmm. an accident that severely damaged his body, and he received this huge financial award from the companies responsible. But the very first thing that you find out is that you're not allowed to find out, not only because he doesn't know what happened to him, but because he's been forbidden by the terms of his agreement to not talk about what actually happened. So there's this huge missing mm-hmm. piece of information. And then throughout, this guy like tries to sort of recreate for himself what's either a real memory that he just can't place, or something that is, you know, sort of imagined, but like try to recreate what he calls reenactments. And he hires all of these people, and he hires tons of people to build these spaces, different spaces. One's in an apartment building. There's one in like a garage. There's one in the streets of London, to try to sort of relive these things in an effort to become real again, or because he feels like he has lost the ability to engage. And all of these things are connected from that first contract that basically told him, you know, you cannot talk about this, to, you know, financial agreements that he mm-hmm. makes, brokerages in right. order to, you know, continue to make money to support himself. Anyway, it's a very complicated novel, right. and it's like kind of, it features heavily in like a lot of people's ideas of like what it means to write a contemporary mm-hmm. novel mm-hmm. now. Like Zadie Smith wrote a right. big thing about it.
Right. And he's not trying to create, he's not trying, from what you're saying, he's not trying to create, to fabricate a myth of origin. He's trying to rediscover through some kind of bodily memory what actually happened in that aha moment.
It's not even that he wants to find out what happened to him, like regain the memory of what happened to him. It's that he has been so severely damaged by this accident that he feels like what he calls secondhand, like everything he knows he's now used. Is secondhand.
Yeah.
And he really has, it's a very dark novel. It's, you know, there's violence and mm-hmm. very strange things that end up coming out of this. But the great thing about this novel is that even though it, you know, sort of conforms to a particular, you know, genre, one would say, you know, the literary form, and it's very, very heavily theorized. There's also this real plain spoken attitude. Like he made his main character somebody who was just a bloke, you know, just a person. And you can see how something bad can happen to somebody who is essentially given the power to make whatever kind of world they want autonomously, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, this person is doing everything he feels like, and nobody says anything because they're being either paid or, you know, just compelled, you know, to so, this person is just doing this stuff.
Okay, so this is a hierarchy of contracts. There's the contract which pays him for the damage done.
And that's what gives him sort of the root money and then everything else that comes out of it.
And then he has contracts with others where he's manipulating them in the same way he's been manipulated.
Yes, but it's very, very straightforward. Like, there's a scene where he, you know, he basically doesn't let his employees leave because they have to be on call to do these reenactments
whenever
he wants. And, you know, they're being paid a lot of money, but they can never leave to spend it. You know, they can never leave these spaces. So it's this really strange thing. And he just says, you know, they signed the contracts and I can move through these spaces how I see fit.
Wow. And what's fascinating to me is the rigidity and the control in this contract-based view of the world. You know, there are, in my own work, I wanted to look at three very different ways of organizing activity. One is contract, which is about rigid. In our developed postmodern economy is incredibly rigid. There's charity, which is another kind of noblesse oblige kind of thing, and dependency that comes from that, and how do you navigate that environment. And then there's what's called covenant. And from my studies, in the original form of covenant, peoples didn't even have to share the same reality, but they would have a meeting where there would need to be the transfer of resources. One had some things and others had others. And they would invoke whatever deities or whatever knowledge base that they each brought to the table. And as the witnesses and as the guarantors, in terms of the supernatural piece of it, or the over or universal piece of it. But the promises made were open-ended. They were vows more than contracts. And a vow has to be negotiated every time it's implemented. So you do for others what they cannot do for themselves, but you don't do for others what they can do for themselves, because that renders a dependency. And also, when you have, it's not a contract, because you don't do, you may, the person may not need what they contracted for, because you may discover that something else is important, and you're still committed, but you have to negotiate it. So the art of working through these things, it's like a marriage. That's the only functional marriage where people negotiate how they are going to go use the resources they have to benefit each other without creating undue dependency or undue power. That's the only remnant of this tradition that we have.
Yeah, it's the connections between the covenant and the contract is something that I don't talk about extensively in my dissertation, but maybe when the book comes. I mean, for me, like, one of, like, my main thesis is also, like, how do we, like, distinguish contract and law? Like, eventually, like how are you going to do that? A contract can be broken. Like, that, like, to me, that there, like, that a contract exists means that it can be breached.
Right.
And either made anew, or you have to, you know, create, you know, if somebody wants to sue you because you broke a contract, they can do that. Too. They don't have to. It's not an imperative, but they can do that. And they can't usually, at least in our system, they can't usually make you do the thing that you said that you were going to do in the contract. Instead, you pay damages.
Right.
And you have, there's various kinds of defenses. And like, whenever those things sort of like disintegrate, or, you know, like with the arbitration clause, it's so like, the arbitration system like is built in, and it's an industry, you know, it's connected to like this, you know, business that is essentially trying to replace the state, you know, and the reason why is because it favors the capitalists. And it does this in a way that like the courts don't currently have the tools to recognize as such. And so, you know, the decision last week, you know, it would split down the lines you would normally think. Gorsuch wrote the opinion, and Ginsburg wrote
the dissent, and it disallowed.
But I was just gonna say that you know, in connection to the work I do, which is like looking at these things through like experimental speculative fiction or even horror, you know, Gorsuch sort of mocked the dissent by saying, "Ah, they think this is apocalyptic, and that's alarmist. There's nothing apocalyptic about this." Whereas Ginsburg was saying, I call on Congress to change this law. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a, there's, you know, usually that doesn't happen, you know, the even dissents don't say anything about politics.
What the other branch needs to do.
Yeah. Or, yeah. I mean, but dissents are also places where, you know, people can say stuff, and there's been many dissents, such as the one in Citizens United where, you know, essentially, you know, it was said, this is a dystopian nightmare. Like, what is being done is changing the world we live in. And then, of course, the opinion, which is, you know, the majority opinion, says that's not true. This is exactly the way things are supposed to be. So seeing those things kind of butt up against each other in the way of, I don't know. I love thinking about this stuff. This is really what I. My bread and butter, I guess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the coalescing and almost becoming rigid of the thinking that allowed corporate personhood and contracts to take over happened from the mid-70s to the mid-80s in terms of popular.
Yeah, but people were calling this stuff way earlier. Like there's articles from the 40s.
Oh yeah,
Yeah, I mean, you know, the word neoliberalism has been coined, and you know, it's the name for like what has, you know, happened since the 70s, Thatcher, Reagan, but people have been recognizing this stuff way before. And the Lochner era was this period of time in what many people know as the Gilded Age, which is actually a Mark Twain thing. But the Lochner era, the reason it's called that is because there was this group of decisions in the Supreme Court where it's very similar to now. And this is something that was brought up in the decision last week. It's called Epic Systems. The alarmist aspect of this was the dissent saying, this is bringing back this practice that was essentially, you know, the New Deal and court packing and all of those things that we like think about in history. That's what stopped basically like this, what is called the Lochnerization of the relationship between consumers, workers, and corporations. And now people are talking about it coming back. Mm-hmm. Not to, you know, darken everybody's doorstep on this Sunday morning, but you know, it really is an issue. And getting this stuff turned around is going to be pretty big, I think. Mm-hmm.
I wish you well on that.
Not for me, but for, well, you know, everybody to vote. And
No, but I think... it's very hard to talk to people about other ways of organizing. We could do law in a covenantal way. You know, and in fact, part of our rights language is locked up in contract assumptions, which make people equal rights or access to specific things that they don't need. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we had a rights basis that were more built on the personhood rather than the biological being, but the personhood, then we would be able to discern what's helpful and what's not helpful, and we could be accountable to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a big part of something that came out of my research, and this is not even something that's talked about really, is that the very first Civil Rights Act was enacted after emancipation in 1866. Guess what the first right is? The right to make and enforce contracts. And from that flows this, you know, idea about being a person. And this is, you know, Hegel comes in, right. You know, like there's all this stuff. But like being a person is what it is to actually make and enforce the agreements. And that, you know, there's a lot of, clearly a lot of trouble that's come out of that, but there's also a lot of potential, I think. Mm-hmm. The idea that like what it is to be a person is to be somebody who's constantly negotiating, creating the ability to plan your future with other people.
Right, right. And this is the Alexander Campbell, one of the founders of my tradition. He debated Robert Owen, the leading socialist at the time, the head of what became Hebrew Union Seminary in Cincinnati. He was on the forefront with lots of different peoples. The cardinal there was the first Protestant Catholic debate in history. He believed that the purpose of government was to debate and negotiate the space that we need for the lives we choose to live, because we make the lives that we live, and we have to take responsibility for it. It's not in rights or it's not in contracts that are out there. It's in the process of living. And so, but when you put the contract, the person piece, and you have a softer notion of contract, then it works. But when you have a hard notion of contract, it's a total breakdown.
Absolutely.
Judy Sill, There's a Rugged Road. Shall we go there?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this song is the first song off of an album called Heart Food. And basically, it's a great album and everybody should check it out. This person was a tragic heroin overdose death, but a person who was trained classical music and actually the monastic tradition of music, and a self-taught Rosicrucian scholar. It's just very interesting.
Wow.
Stranger strikes solitary. Blessed is the lonesome pioneer. Roll on, roll on, roll on. Night birds are flying. Come on, the light is gone. Hope slowly dying. Tell me how you come by through. Still surveying the mind.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Michaela Brangan. So, Michaela, the way we close the show out is with, you know, kind of talking about how you learned to take care of yourself, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and how do you know when you need to do that?
Mm. Well, I'm sort of bad at taking care of myself, honestly. I mean, I think I've eat healthily, and mm-hmm. I, you know, sort of different habits I have are probably like, you know, keeping me healthy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Don't get sick very often. Right. One thing though that I have found that I am really grateful that I came to was acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
I started doing acupuncture a few months ago because I had problems with my arms from writing.
Computer use, yes.
Bad posture. Like I said, like not very good at taking care of myself. But, you know, I finally went ahead and like tried it, and I was just stunned by the difference it's made.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, it hasn't like, it's not a cure-all or anything like that, but I go to Ithaca Community Acupuncture, do mm-hmm. a little plug. hopefully we don't have like the...
Yeah, you're good.
The relationship, but... yeah, I found even just the other day, like I got it done, and it has like an overall great effect on my ability to sort of charge through. Because currently I do have, you know, kind of a lot of my plate, like sort of wrapping things up here and mm-hmm. finishing and trying to, you know, plan for my move and sure. everything like that. So, yeah, I would say acupuncture has been really key. I have a partner named Vincent, and he is lovely and really himself, you know, I don't know, very patient, and I'm very grateful to him for being so nice to me even when I'm a pain in the ass. Oh, excuse me. and yeah, and also I have pets, and I think that like I've always had pets, and I know some people don't like animals for various reasons, either allergies or just, you know, mm-hmm. sort of things, but like it's caring for others, and caring for my animals, and like they like to care for me too, you know, like mm-hmm. they can like tune into that kind of stuff. Those are the things that, I mean, I would say that I try to think about self-care a lot, and I don't always do the best mm-hmm. work on that. I do go to a therapist too, which has been great too, mm-hmm. but sorry, that's a little bit random, but
well,
cats and acupuncture.
right. And actually, you know, I had a dentist who's also an acupuncturist talking, who wrote a book called The Road to Mudra on the show a while back, and how he integrates Western medicine, Eastern practices, as well as kind of a deep spiritual awareness. I mean, we cover lots of different territories here, but when did you realize, I mean, everybody apologizes for their self-care, not everybody, but most people do. When did you learn that it was your responsibility? When did you realize that I have to take care of me because nobody else is going to do it? I mean, coming out of the background you are, I imagine some things came really early and some things came really late, but when did you kind of begin to put the puzzle together?
Oh man, I feel like I'm still putting it together. I don't know.
That's most of us are. I am still.
Yeah. I think, one of the things about me that might be, that people know about me is that I don't intentionally put other people first. I wouldn't say that I'm like this self-sacrificing, like, oh, like I'm always putting people first, but like I will, work myself over in order to like try to accomplish a goal. And like often, you know, I see other people get the benefit of that before I can let myself get mm-hmm. the benefit mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm still putting it together. I think, in relation to my background, I've always been really, really independent. Mm-hmm. And so like I have cared, you know, been able to care for myself for a pretty long time. Mm-hmm. I started working when I was 15, and like, Not that I was like dependent on that, but I don't know. It's always just been kind of part of my life, and mm-hmm. actually treating myself and actually letting myself be cared for by other people.
It's probably a bigger challenge.
It's really hard. I mean, I like always trying to make myself more available to that way of thinking. But you know, I think it's been good. You mm-hmm. know, if you're aware of it, if you're not just like always accepting yeah. or always receiving.
And I've been in a relationship now for 5 years where it's taken me that long to really allow my partner to care for me in ways that, because I would usually, she'd say, what do you need? Oh, and then I jump up and get it or whatever. I get it for both of us or whatever, rather than just be taken care of. And mm-hmm. and sometimes you need to just be able to receive it, because you can't really give it if you can't receive it.
That's right.
What impresses me is that you're just available to others, and that's kind of like the anti-contract thing, which is to be present and available rather than locked down and committed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a different way to live. That's with a real sense of agency.
Yeah, I hope so.
Good to get to know you, Michaela.
Good to meet you too.
So we're going to close with Silly Wizard Tin the Broom o' Cowdenknowes.
Broom of the Cowdenknowes. Yeah.
Okay. Anything about this?
Yeah, this is a song from my childhood, and it's just a beautiful ballad. And my mother's Scottish; she's from Scotland, and I, you know, listen to this song a lot.
Here we go.
So, enjoy.
All the broom, the ball.